Welcome to the ProWrestling.net podcast. I am Jason Powell, and it's my pleasure today to be joined by John Filipowicz, one of the filmmakers of the soon-to-be-named DC documentary. I guess we'll start there, John. Do you have a name? I know you're not releasing it, but do you have a name in mind and just decided not to put it out there yet?
Yeah, that was a tough decision. Kevin Tiernan, you know, my co-filmmaker, and I were, like, really opposed to promoting a film without the name. But, you know, we need money for legal to be able to make sure we've got the name in good standing for the future, you know. So the decision was made that we would just promote it as the Unauthorized DCW Documentary. And then we fought about the word unauthorized with our production manager, and he convinced us to use that. So, I mean, it is, and it's, you know, smart to protect yourself by making it clear this is not a WWE product, you know.
Yeah, and I think most people are aware, but I certainly want to give let you plug the Kickstarter program. You have reached your goal, and congratulations on that. The goal was $23,200. Right now you are sitting at $25,745 as we record this. But for people going, oh, good, they made their goal, it's all good, I can just kick back now. Tell us why it's important that, you know, that the more money you make, the better you can do with this project.
Yeah, absolutely. Our first, we have, if you go to Kickstarter.com and you search ECW, you'll find our project and read through everything. At the bottom of the page, there's a frequently asked questions that we put up the minute that we made our goal, because one of our backers said, hey, you, it looks like you're going to reach your goal. What are you going to do if there's extra money? And I said, a lot of things, you know. The original budget was $10,000 more. It was actually $33,200. I was definitely afraid of asking for that much money. I was still definitely afraid of asking for $23,000, but it was like, it was necessary. It was explained to me when I looked over the numbers. I went, oh, man. So we had to cut a lot of things in half. We had to cut licensing in half. We had to cut film festival budget in half. There were several. We had to take, remove some of the premiere stuff from it. We want to do a really nice professional premiere in the Philadelphia area when this is done and have, you know, all of our backers come and see it. So this extra helps with a lot of things, and music too. We're doing original music for this, you know. So it helps us record music. It helps with post-production. It helps us make the film look nicer. You know, it does a lot of little things. So, you know, keep pledging. And the thing is that, you know, for people who don't know, it's not like you're just donating it and then maybe you'll come see it or something. It's a way to pre-order the DVD, quite frankly. I mean, you start at $10 and you can get access to our backer clips. We have a bunch of stuff that goes up there first. I'm sure some people have seen our clips, our outtakes and whatnot, or extended clips of stuff we are going to use around the internet. We put those up there first. So starting at $10, you get that. At $20, you get a limited edition movie poster, you know, plus the backer site. Everything gets added on top. And then at $30, you get the DVD. And the cool thing is that we decided within the last 2 weeks that there are going to be two versions on the DVD. There'll be the commercial cut, which is, you know, the film festival cut, which will be, you know, run anywhere from 90 minutes to an hour 40. And then there'll be an extended cut, which will probably run, you know, around 2 hours and 15 minutes to 2 hours and 20 minutes, I figure. So if you want more, you'll get more. You know, you have the options there. And then the pledges keep going up, you know. There's still, if anybody's interested, you know, you want a private premiere screening before everybody else sees it, we'll come to your house. And for a little extra money, we'll bring an ECW wrestler with us, too. And they're all safe people. I when they pitched me that idea, I went, oh, that doesn't sound good. And then they gave me a list, and it was all people I'm actually friendly with. And they're people that I would have in my own house. So you're safe. It's Steve Bloomies and Stevie Richards and Shane Douglas and Jerry Lynn's and Angel from the Baldies of the world, you know.
Oh, very good. Well, let me ask you another obvious question that I think a lot of people out there have asked. Why another ECW documentary?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, because I didn't feel like there was a straight documentary on ECW, first of all. Well, actually, first of all, we started it in March of 2000.
Right.
So we had a lot of this stuff as it was falling apart and everything. And we realized from watching those, you know, they were wrestling videos, and that isn't quite what we were going for. Our movie doesn't have anything to do with, you know, character profiles and storylines and, you know, going over angles. That was a lot of, you know, what Rise and Fall did. And I loved it because I was an old ECW fan, but it isn't really critical. It isn't really what I was trying to do, you know, as far as being a filmmaker. And we structured it so it would tell, you know, the human story of this from, you know, all aspects, including, you know, from the wrestlers, from fans, from front office people that you probably don't know about, you probably do, Jason, but a lot of other people that don't necessarily know some of the people that will be presenting that were heavily involved in ECW. I just felt there were a lot of things that were kind of left out along the way, you know, from the formation to the Eddie Gilbert years. I didn't feel like there was any, sorry for the noise. I didn't feel like there was any, I didn't feel like there was good coverage, I should say, of the mass transit incident that could have cost them the pay-per-view. And there were several other incidents that, or things that I didn't feel like were gone into at all or with any depth at least. And I wanted to do something that was kind of objective, that wasn't from wrestling people. And the main thing is that one of the things that we really focus on is why these guys did what they did and why the business did what it did. We got journalists, you know, like yourself, you appear in our film, who kind of give us context as to what Heyman and the wrestlers were thinking during that time period in the 90s, why wrestling was like it was, what was happening. So you get a clearer idea for somebody who doesn't watch wrestling. This is being made with the idea of, if you don't know about wrestling in the 90s, that's okay. You know, we'll explain that to you. If you're not a big fan, but you're interested in a subculture, we're going to study this subculture for you and show it to you. So I think there's, you know, there's a lot of differences, but, you know, to finish up, what I was saying before, the main thing for me is really, you know, we put out that segment about, you know, the violence in ECW on the internet, and I definitely, it's on our Kickstarter page. Go check that out. That gives you an idea of kind of what we're doing differently. I mean, the tone of it, and the way we're looking into why these guys would put their body through harm. I mean, I think the stuff with Axel Rotten is really compelling as far as how he felt throughout the years about what he did and the sacrifices he made for ECW.
Now, I just want to give people a heads up. If you know, for everyone listening on either version of ProWrestling.net, both members and regular, wherever you click this to watch, you will find a link to the Kickstarter page. So it's as easy as that. If you're listening on iTunes, just head to ProWrestling.net, and you'll find an easy access link as well, so that you can find out, you know, even if you don't plan on pledging, you can certainly take a look at some of the footage that's out there, and maybe you'll change your mind. And I asked that ECW, you know, why another question, just because that has been some of the feedback. I'm very
Absolutely.
Excited.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, personally, I'm very excited. You and I met, what year was it, John? Was it 2001?
Yes, September of 2001 in Vegas, we met up.
And so I can no longer lie to people and say that the footage was actually filmed last week, as I've been trying to do. but yeah, Las Vegas 2001, and I mean, you guys have gone through hell to make this thing.
Yes.
I don't know how many people really can really understand the level of passion. Back then, correct me if I'm wrong, did you guys like crash in your car that night?
No, we found a $50 motel.
Okay.
We didn't have money for food, though. So Bruce Mitchell or you or Wade Keller, somebody in that crew gave us buffet tickets because we kind of ran out of money the first night trying to find a cheap diner. Yeah, we have crashed in our car for this project, though. Yeah, everything was done on the cheap.
And so when exactly did this whole project begin for you?
Well, the official beginning was March of 2000, and the original idea was crap. It was fluffy. It was, and not to say that this documentary is some kind of a hit piece, but it certainly got a lot more integrity to it now. The original idea was, like, I loved going to the ECW arena. It had kind of been a special place for me, and And I thought that the shows there were very unique. It was an interesting atmosphere, and more so the culture surrounding it, because, you know, people would come every week, and if you were like me, you didn't have money for like a front row seat. You had to get general admission, which, and it was first come, first serve, which means that people started camping out there around 11 in the morning, and that thing was a whole culture of cookouts and people getting completely drunk and people interacting with others, and there would be bonfires, and it was crazy. It was a subculture. So I wanted to try and document that in some way, and I felt like I needed some interviews to help flesh that out. And so we went to we got access to the fan convention, the internet fan convention that year, and interviewed a few people. Not very well. I've gotten a lot better. And I'd say I kept bugging Todd Gordon. I like stalked Todd Gordon. And I finally got an interview with Todd. I got him to confirm it in December of 2000 for a month, for after the holidays. He wanted to wait.
Let me just get in there for, because
sure.
You know, one thing I think you and I tend to forget, there's a generation now that hasn't really been exposed
right.
to anything but new ECW. So Todd Gordon was the owner of ECW. Go ahead.
He was the founder, yeah.
Yes.
He was the owner up until he sold it to Paul Heyman. Well, you don't even know if he sold it because, I mean, something exchanged hands, but, you know, he's very evasive in our interview, which we get into in our documentary about how it changed hands, but Todd founded it, and I wanted to get an interview with him because he was a Philadelphia guy, and I bugged him on the phone, and then I moved to Philadelphia to go to the University of the Arts, and it was less than a mile away from his jewelry shop that he owns in Center City, so I would walk there, and I'd bug him in person, you know. And finally, he was nice enough to give us an interview, and I studied for a month. I knew by then I wanted to do something a lot more serious and critical. It wasn't quite what it became, you know, what I'm proud of, but it was still, I mean, I asked him about everything, and he, you know, bless his heart, because he sat there for 2.5 hours while these two 19-year-old kids, you know, grilled him about the history of ECW and what he did right and what he did wrong.
And so, I mean, you mentioned it was kind of going to be a fluffy thing. How has it evolved? You obviously had the delays just because of the lack of funding, and I assume, even though, you know, there has to be a big part of you that wishes years ago you could have put a wrap on this.
Yeah, oh yeah, but now I'm very happy we didn't.
Yeah, I mean, just because you've matured and whatnot.
Yeah, I think it's a lot better product. I think waiting helped not just with us, you know, but also with the narratives, and we got the Extreme Reunion thing this year, so we got to interview a lot of people and catch up with them 11 years apart from their initial interview. That becomes kind of something we bounce back and forth in the film is this little last hurrah moment, you know, that weekend along with the history of it. And I think that worked out really well, so you can see where these guys got to and how they feel about things now. And, you know, I think especially for like a mainstream audience, it really, really helps to crystallize some of the issues of things, you know, without giving too much away. You get to see, you know, where some of these guys are in their 40s. Some of them good, some of them, you know, the picture that we paint, you know, from the footage we have is some of them are in trouble, you know?
Right, yeah, unfortunately. And just, you said fluffy. Had it come out back in the day, do you feel, or at least what your original vision was, had that come out, would you look back on it as maybe fanboy material compared to what it's going to be now?
I think within the first year, yes.
Okay.
I think once we got the Todd Gordon interview, it was definitely different. But I think it would have dealt with a lot more with angle. It would have dealt more with stuff that only wrestling fans would have cared about, which is like angles and, you know, storyline stuff. And, you know, Rise and Fall really helped put that to bed for us, which is good because we've got over 50 hours of footage. Our first draft was still like 3 hours long. You know, there's going to be a completest director's cut, you know, probably a year from now, that some people will really enjoy, and my partner Kevin Kiernan will just shake his head at because he's like, oh, it's too long. It kept evolving. I mean, there was a time where we were thinking of following around like three people, doing more of something like Beyond the Mat, also involved with the history. We were going to do somebody from the, you know, the early days, which was going to be Ted Petty. We were going to follow around Bill Alfonso, who's kind of your middle years, and then Steve Carino, because we had access to these people. And it just didn't quite work out for us. It just didn't. And that's another thing I'm kind of glad we didn't do. You know, we shot a lot of stuff that won't be used, you know. But, yeah, and it just kept evolving. And this year when we picked it back up, we really, really, we had hours and hours of meetings about the narrative. And then just cutting up the first cut, you know, trying to be fair. There's a lot of issues where people take different stances on in our film. And I wanted very much to be fair and objective and look at this like a journalist. And to do that, it kind of takes time.
Yeah.
In this, not only in the editing room, but it also takes time in the actual film. Because if somebody says one thing, you've got to have a counterpoint. And, you know, you worry about, oh, if this guy says the last thing, does that mean we think he's right? You know, it's one of the reasons we decided not to do narration very early on in the process, if we could get away with it. And I think we have. We've accomplished that goal. We just wanted to present things fairly, you know. It's a mix of fact and some opinions, and, you know, there are disputes within it, which is interesting for a film, you know.
I want to talk about your filmmaking partner, Kevin Kiernan.
Yeah, elusive Kevin Kiernan.
Yeah, he's not a pro wrestling, but you're like a lifelong, very passionate wrestling fan.
Yes.
You still write about it today. Was it hard to sell Kevin on this concept in the very beginning?
Oh, initially, no, because I told him it would only take 3 months, which is great. And there have been a few times where we thought we were going to restart again, and I know I have two things I want to say is, one, that, you know, we want to thank you, Jason, because I've kept in touch with you, and you've always been very supportive and helpful to us at times. You've always been very fair to us. And the other thing is just that, you know, this interview is very exciting for my friend Tommy Murphy. He is the hugest Jason Powell fan. He lives and dies by Powell's point of view.
Oh, my God, I didn't know there was one.
Yes. So Tommy, I could tell him anything that any other journalist says, and he's like, what does Jason Powell think, man? I go by Jason Powell's point of view, so Tommy loves you.
Oh, Tommy, I'm sorry, Tommy. Tommy, you're my hero. Thank you.
But, yeah, so got those things out of the way. What was the question again? I'm sorry, I took this off track.
Well, just getting Kevin, you said it, you know, you thought it would be a three-month project, and here we are all these years later. I mean, honestly, could there have been, like, a documentary made on the making of this movie? I would assume there had to be some clashes between you two along the way, even.
Oh, there still are.
Yeah.
We're still sitting here arguing about stuff and what goes in and what doesn't. And, you know, there were a few times where we didn't work together for a few years. We were still friends. I mean, we're like brothers. You know, I practically, you know, spend half my day, you know, up at his parents' place working on stuff in our studio. But, yeah, I had to kind of convince him to come back this year, which was, you know, I'm so thankful he did, because he's the conscience of this film. He's the conscience. He knows so much about the wrestling industry, and yet he doesn't watch wrestling. You know, from being able to watch a match and kind of, you know, critique what he does or doesn't like, or what he sees as logical or not, all the way to, like, the business end of it, because we've been backstage at so many shows, and he's dealt with every level of wrestling personnel and wrestling journalists and whatnot. He kind of soaks it up like a sponge. I don't know that he wants to, you know, put this information to use at any time after we're done, but.
Yeah, so he's gone through all of this, and he's still not a fan, but has his outlook on the wrestling business changed, either for the positive or the negative.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? My phone was being weird.
Oh, sure. With Kevin, he's not, you know, because he's not a fan, I'm curious, like, through all of this, all these years of meeting all these people, has he become at all more interested, or just maybe how has his outlook changed, either positively or negatively, as far as, you know, regarding the wrestling industry?
He thinks it's a place for crazy people. He understands it very well. He can talk to people about it, but he just thinks that there's a lot of things that are just nuts in it. You know, and part of that just comes from dealing, you know, with wrestlers and hearing the different, you know, political things that come out of wrestling. It's just it amazes him. I don't I think he has an appreciation for the art form. I shouldn't say I think. He's spoken about that. You know, there are things that he's seen at a show and gone, that, you know, that's good wrestling. That's, you know, something that I appreciate as an art form. But the craziness of you know, some of the stuff that we go into in the film, he's just, the idea of blading to him is just, it's just crazy.
And so take me back to how many hours of interview footage and how many man hours did you put in on this project when you had to bring it to a halt? Kind of bring me through that timeline.
Wow, yeah, okay. We spent a lot of 2000 kind of working to get interviews, because at first, see, now it's great, you know, especially this week. Everybody's calling me, offering me interviews and stuff. It wasn't like that. At the beginning, we had to get Todd Gordon, and then that gave us some credibility. He referred us to a few people and vouched for us. And also, in fairness, Todd said some things in his interview that led me to people like, you know, Bruce Mitchell of the Pro Wrestling Torch, or Ed Zahn, who was an old promoter who had a split with ECW. Based on things that Todd said in his interview, I wanted to be fair and give people a chance to counterpoint his I don't know if accusations is the correct word, but things that he said were true. So, 2001, man, wow. God, I'm not good at calculating things like this, but it was hundreds of hours in 2001.
Sure.
And then in 2002, and then it got slow, and then it got picked up again in 2003. Then again in 2005, we spent a good month thinking that we were going to do it again. And I personally, apart from Kev, spent, oh God, a good 2 months working almost every day to catalog all the footage, minute by minute, what people were saying, where I think it would go in the film. Just a lot of, it's a lot of structuring. There's a lot of busy work. I mean, just this past month, you know, I have to go through all the B-roll, all the fan cam footage, select what I think might be interesting footage to show, and, you know, I'm pulling hours and hours of this footage for, like, you know, an hour and a half movie and an extended cut that's only going to be, you know, 2 hours and 15 minutes, you know. So I'm doing a lot of work so that I have a lot of choices, but at the end of the day, a lot of it's just work that's never going to see the light of day, kind of a thing.
Okay. And so, roughly, you said there were some stops and starts in there. Was there ever a point where you just thought, this is it, it's not happening, we spent all of this time, and it's, or did you always know, we're getting back to this eventually?
No, we thought it was dead. I mean, after 2008, I had a conversation with Kevin. He's just like, you know, I'm sorry, man, it's done. You know, he's like, this last option didn't work out, and, you know, he's just like, kind of moved on with his life, and, you know, and it sucked, and it didn't even, the money didn't even matter to us. I mean, we were talking the other day, we estimate we've probably spent, you know, probably like $8,000 in the decade up until this year. Never all at once. I mean, we never had a lot of money, but it was like a little bit, I mean, that Vegas trip, you know, we had to beg, borrow, and steal to get out there, and we didn't even have food money, but, you know, the whole trip, all told, between the two of us probably cost, you know, over $1,000.
Wow.
You know, that right there was, a big hit, you know, just to get a few interviews. But I'm glad we did, you know, we use that stuff. It's all good, you know, content that helps you flesh out your narrative, your story. But, yeah, we thought it was dead. You know, in fact, this got, we rechristened this in January when I got a few calls, and it was spurred on by the closing of the ECW Arena. And I actually went to that show as a fan, just because the arena had meant a lot to me, and I wanted to catch up with a bunch of friends I just hadn't seen because I hadn't been going to shows. And I actively avoided several people that I knew would ask me about the documentary because I was just so embarrassed. You know, I brought up to you, you know, when we were talking earlier, you and I have corresponded for years now, but whenever it would come up, you know, I might send you something and go, I think something might happen. And I just really felt like the boy who cried wolf. You know, it was embarrassing after a while. And it bothered me because this was a project I felt very passionate about. And, it, you know, now it's taken up a third of my life. I'm 31 now. And I don't mean that in a negative way. This has been an amazing journey, and especially this last year has just been really neat. But, you know, it was the number one thing on my so-called bucket list. You know, I always felt like I wanted to do this story justice and make something that I could be proud of and hopefully fans could be proud of, you know.
Well, I'd like you to explain to people when, you know, when they say, hey, somebody's looking for a handout here. What are these? What are the expenses? I mean, you mentioned the Las Vegas trip to come out and interview us, and you know, not just travel, but what exactly is the $23,000 plus that you were looking to raise? What is that going for?
Oh yeah, all that, like when I talked about we estimated we spent like $8,000 and all, that's not included. We're not getting paid back for that. This was a budget that our project manager put together of what we could do to make a successful film that we could get out to the most people possible on our own, you know, self-distribution, which meant, you know, we needed money for marketing. We needed money for a ton of incidentals, which is, you know, anything from computer stuff to hard drives, you know, programs, stuff like that. That just help in the post-production process. We had a little bit of a budget for film to enter film festivals, because those are actually really costly. It actually costs a lot to enter, you know, good film festivals that you might be able to get an audience outside of wrestling to recognize you in. God, what were some of the others on the list? Licensing was a big one. You know, any footage that we use in there that we didn't shot, you know, you got to pay for, you know, or photography, you know. And there were a lot of interesting pieces of footage that I wanted to try to grab that, you know, were costly, or especially mainstream footage. If, you know, somebody, you know, if ECW was covered on, like, American Journal did a story about that, an Inside Edition. I wanted to try to get those. You know, now hopefully, you know, with extra money, we can be able to do that. It was just a million little things that all added up. There was no one cost where it was like $10,000, you know.
Right. And just out of curiosity, you mentioned with the film festivals, I just, you know, as a novice, I certainly enjoy movies and whatnot, but you actually have to pay for the right just to have your movie screened at these festivals?
You have to pay for the right to have the option.
How does that work?
They have like three different deadlines. There's like an early deadline. I'm trying to think of what would be, okay, I'm going to be semi-inaccurate here just because I looked at a ton of film festivals just the other week just to try to do some math in my head. There's an early bird kind of thing where you send in your movie. There's the natural deadline, and then there's the this is really late, you know, but we'll look at it deadline. And, like, the late deadlines are as much as, like, $75 or $100 for some of, like, the, you know, the bigger ones, like, you know, Toronto International Film Festival or South by Southwest or, you know, Tribeca. If they accept, that money's gone no matter what. So you're literally paying for them to look at your film. And if they like it, then they'll screen it at their film festival. But if they don't like it, you just, you know, you paid them to look at your film, essentially. And that's just the way it is. It's a racket, you know. Now, I know that, you know, if you get a name value to your film in any sense, once you've been out there, I know that it works in reverse in that you get paid a screening fee.
Okay.
Which is, you know, a couple hundred dollars. You know, I'm good friends with the guys who run the Southside Film Festival and on the campus of Lehigh University. And I know that they try to grab a bunch of films that screened at Sundance or Toronto. And those films generally cost anywhere from $400 to $800 to screen it once or twice.
Interesting.
So you can make money back on it if you get accepted into a big one, but the big ones cost money to get it, you know, to get the option of being accepted in.
Well, what is your goal? When all is said and done, I mean, what's like the pie in the sky expectation and maybe a more modest expectation? I mean, do you believe that over time you can, you know, start to make some of your money back, or like you say, is it that $8,000 is just gone?
You know what? I've always said, money really wasn't an option, or not an option. Money isn't as important to me as kind of integrity. I know that's very artsy, idealistic of me. That's just the way I am. My partner is even more so the same way. it really wasn't necessarily about the money so much as that we got to make our film on our terms.
Yeah.
Do I think that we have an opportunity to make some money? I hope so. You know, I'd like to at least be compensated, you know, if people like it and they go, oh, God, this guy worked hard, you know. That's not a mechanism, but that's just a circumstance of, you know, putting it out there and trying to get it seen by as many people as possible. I mean, I know that there are people who are talking about distribution with our, you know, with our project manager. I don't know if anything like that's going to happen. I know there's a lot of interesting options out there, you know, and I'd like to get it seen by the most amount of people. But the truth is, I want to make a film that I can be proud of, and if I can make enough money to pay off school, that would be cool. You know, I dropped back into school this year. That's another thing. This is the year of doing things that I should have done a while ago. I dropped back into community college. So
welcome to your 30s.
Yeah, exactly. So I would just like to be able to not starve while I'm going to school, you know, as I try to, you know, little by little do school part-time. So I don't need to make a massive amount of money, just as long as I can be proud of it, you know?
Right. And it sounds like the movie, as I've heard you talk about it, this isn't something where the diehard ECW fan is going to be the only person that appreciates this. I think your goal is more, the diehard ECW fan can bring his brother who doesn't care about wrestling or his sister who doesn't care about wrestling, and they'll get something out of it. Is that fair to say?
That's exactly what we're going for. It's a study of a subculture, and that's a subculture, to be honest. Because pro wrestling in itself is a subculture that people either love or they just completely dismiss and thumb their nose at. And ECW is like the subculture of pro wrestling, especially in the 90s. So, yeah, the goal is I want you to take your non-wrestling fan friend to go see this or buy the DVD and show it to them, and then hopefully you have an intelligent discussion during or after the film about what we present, you know, because we don't really have like a position piece on this, so to speak. You know, there's not a big agenda to it. So when you see, you know, Axel Rotten and he shows you his scars and I ask him, you know, why would you do that? And he talks about why he did that, his rationale for doing it. I think that's interesting to a normal person who would be just appalled that somebody would do that to their forehead, their arm, you know, go through fire, jump off of balconies. And seeing them as human beings talking about this, and then you can decide, was it worth it or not for them, or why was it worth it, or the conditions that these wrestlers wrestled in for little money, you know, without health insurance. I think there's some interesting discussions to be had from that. It's certainly, you know, it's not exactly how wrestling is. Certainly WWF has helped conditions in the past few years. But it's still not like, you know, there's a union, there's universal health insurance if you're a pro wrestler. You know, there's a lot of, you know, little things that still go on in wrestling, especially with indie shows that, you know, it's questionable.
Sure. And I'm kind of jumping all over here, but while I'm thinking about
sure.
the whole distribution, have you had, I mean, is there any consideration to perhaps WWE Studios picking this up now that they're starting to actually invest in outside projects?
I would be amazed if that would happen, only
okay.
because of the unflinching way that we're dealing with the content. I don't know that they really want to be represented like that. They're very careful about their image.
Right.
And I mean, maybe they'll just try to buy it just so that it doesn't exist. I doubt they'd even care.
Sure.
You know.
When you first got into this, I guess let's go back there. And you start interviewing people. Maybe what was the first moment as a fan where maybe something occurred that just kind of made you look at the industry differently, even? You know, now that you're backstage, you're interviewing different people. Was there a moment that you can really remember where it's just maybe something just caught you off guard? You thought you knew more than you did about the industry.
I think, you know, when we got Axel Rotten's initial interview, you know, because we interviewed him twice, but when we got his initial interview, it was right after ECW had closed. And Axel, as I recall, wasn't even there the last, you know, 6 months to a year, because he'd had, you know, personal problems. But talking to him about it was eye-opening, only from a sense of everybody kind of pushes the whole team atmosphere of ECW. He's the first person I interviewed that was like, you know, well, fuck that. I was a team player and I got fucked. You know, like, and now I look back at it and I feel, you know, I have a lot to say about it. I thought that was pretty eye-opening. I mean, talking to Todd Gordon, you know, which is the initial big interview, was real eye-opening just to see, you know, to get a sense for how the front office saw things as they kind of rose to prominence.
Right. Paul Heyman, obviously, I think when you mention ECW, that's probably the first person people think of. You were unable to get him to go on camera and sit down for an interview. I mean, it's not necessarily Paul's style. How much effort did you make at trying to pull that off?
A lot.
Yeah.
A lot, man. I was like, a lot of this whole movie exists because when I was 19 or 20, I was just a ridiculously ballsy kid. And I put my life into it. We made a lot of headway early on, and we made friends with people, and I would have people that I knew that he was friendly with that liked us. I would write an email, and they would forward it to him, or they would call him and then talk and then get back to me. And, you know, I tried a bunch of times over the years. I used to call his parents' house and leave messages on the answering machine. Nothing rude, but, you know.
Yeah.
Saying, hey, we'd like to talk to you. We got to the point where I emailed him back and forth a few years ago. It really didn't go anywhere. You know, he doesn't show his cards, as you know. You know, he just wanted to see what we had. And I said, you know, we don't have a ton edited, but we have like a trailer, and I'm not going to send it to you. But I would meet with you and show it to you, and we can discuss things. You know, it doesn't have to be on camera. You know, and he didn't want to do that. Like, well, he just basically just never wrote me back.
Did you ever get to a point where you thought, hey, maybe, you know, the ice is cracked. I think there's a chance this is going to happen.
No.
Really? Okay.
No. I thought, you know, this year we were talking to somebody that didn't end up getting interviewed, but that we thought that Heyman would want a counterpoint. And I thought maybe, you know, with the time passing and we kind of had some momentum on our project. And then somebody texted me, Paul Heyman showed up on Raw, and I went, oh, well, that kind of disqualifies him from talking to us. You know, they're not going to allow him to participate. You know, not that he was jumping at the chance, obviously, but.
And how much change was there with some of the people? I mean, one of the fascinating parts of this is that because you started the project when you did and you've conducted various interviews with people, some of the same subjects over the years,
mm-hmm.
with the guys that maybe you interviewed back in the day compared to more recently and some even in between, how much has their perception of Paul Heyman changed?
I think they're more thankful now. Not everyone. But I think, first of all, a lot of the when we met up with people again, that a lot of it was shot at the Extreme reunion in April. So you're getting people who are all getting back together for like a high school reunion. They're all older. They even if they don't realize it consciously, subconsciously, they know this is a really great payday for a job that I'm still doing that I'm, you know, never going to make a ton of money at anymore, most likely. So they were, I don't know, softer is not really the word. It's hard to say ECW wrestlers were softer. They were more appreciative of where they came from in some cases. You know, then you have people like New Jack who are just like, you know, fuck Paul Heyman. You know, like, and he's a very entertaining interview the way he went about it. But I thought that they were, I thought they showed a little bit more perspective, or at least omitted. A lot of them omitted talking about Paul unless I directly asked them about it. They wanted to talk more about the guys and what they all went through.
Was there a point maybe in the middle years where I would assume that when you were interviewing people, well, I guess by the time you started this, we were, you know, it was dying days. I know you reminded me, we talked about it, my memory's so awful. But
yeah.
So I guess maybe around that time, was there a lot of bitterness from some of the guys that were in
okay. Oh, yeah, yeah. And there was denial, too. I mean, it was crazy to be like a 19, 20-year-old kid who was still pretty plugged into what was going on, but still young, you know? And a lot of times I get the impression that I had a more realistic view of what was going on than some of these guys. Not because they were, dumb, but because they were so emotionally involved in this team atmosphere and this, and that, you know, they were outlaws and this was the place where the outlaws hung out. And they didn't really want to let that go. And there were guys that were just in denial. I mean, even after Heyman had filed bankruptcy, I would talk to guys who were like, now he's restructuring, you know, until he calls me. Till he calls me and I know, and he never made a phone call. For whatever reason, he let it go. He got to a point where Paul Heyman was okay with it. He found another, you know, rock to jump to, and he moved on. And he kind of left the guys behind in a lot of ways. Not everybody. I'm sure he got people jobs through his standing in WWE. I know there was something in our interview where there was it's something that we don't actually use in the film because it was very dated, but we discussed there was rumors that he filled out talent evaluations of his roster and handed it in to the WWE.
Yeah. I don't know. Rumors. I think it's probably mm-hmm. best to say, but I would be surprised if it didn't happen. I mean, if I'm Vince McMahon hiring Paul Heyman, that's something I'm going to want. They've had success with different people from ECW over the years. I would certainly want that. Mm-hmm. With Paul, I guess, did he ever give you a definitive reason why he wasn't doing it, or does it just go back to he doesn't show his cards?
He doesn't show his cards, no.
What's your best guess?
There were people – I don't think he wanted to answer the kind of questions we were asking.
Okay.
And I don't mean to say that to like necessarily puff out my chest, but even in those early days, I know that people who he talked to regularly would say, you should talk to these guys. You know, they're asking really good questions. And I'm sure he went, oh, that's interesting, cool, what are they talking about? And I'm sure he gleaned from talking to enough people that we weren't going to say, hey, wasn't it so cool when Sandman came Tommy Dreamer? You know, we were going to ask him about, you know, real issues within wrestling and real issues within his company. Not all necessarily negative thinking questions, and we don't bury Paul in our film, though he's not consciously trying to, you know. But I just don't think – I think he's smart enough to know, well, there's nothing really in it for me. We don't pay for interviews, you know. We don't give him a huge spotlight because we're indie filmmakers. He had a job in he ended up with a job in WWE where he got to essentially narrate a wrestling video about ECW's history and put his spin on it. I think the only thing that would have been in it for him is kind of a battle of wills or wits with me in trying to, you know, answer the questions. I think that challenge would have been like the only thing that, from knowing what I know of Paul Heyman, somebody I've studied for years, I think the only thing that would have been in it for him is to try to make me his buddy within the process of the interview. And I don't think that he cares that much about me that it would have, you know, happened.
You think there's I agree with a lot of what you're saying here. And do you think there is also something to, he just has moved on? I mean, I've talked
yes.
to him about different, you know, he's told me in conversations that, you know, you're not going to see me. I'm sure he's had offer for, you know, a million shoot tapes. They do pay. And I'm, in some cases, I think because he's held out so long, he's probably received some, you know, pretty handsome offers from people.
Oh, yeah.
And he turns those down. He's not going to be the convention guy signing autographs. And, you know, for a while, any time that somebody holds out like that, you always wonder, are they doing it just to drive up their price long term? Like, they don't really need it now, but they know if they wait, it's going to really mean something and then cash in big payday. Do you think maybe a lot of it is he just was ready to move on with his life and also, obviously, you know, not have to answer those tough questions in addition to that?
Absolutely. If you're, like, doing something else with your life, and he's a creative guy, I respect him, man. I spend a lot of my time trying to be creative, and I respect what he did. He kept me involved in wrestling as a fan for years. You know, I have a lot of respect for what he did creatively. Yeah, I know he was interested in MMA and buying into Strikeforce, and I think that, like, yeah, again, what's in it for me? He's probably sitting there going, like, dude, you know, I did ECW, and the end sucked, and people, hated me, and now I got to avoid calls. But I have this, you know, these other things that I want to move forward to because I'm a creative person. I'm a forward-thinking person. Why do I want to even bother with that? You know what I mean? I completely sympathize and understand, you know?
You mentioned, you know, you're not consciously trying to bury him. That has to be tough. As a filmmaker, I'm guessing he would be number one on your wish list of people you weren't able to get, and feel free to correct me if I'm wrong on that. But
no, he's probably second at this point.
Oh, okay. Do you mind saying who's first?
No. I'm sorry. Out of respect to the person, there was somebody in ECW's front office for the last few years that would have, that I met with, actually. I had a two-hour meeting with, and told me a lot of fascinating tidbits, and we were negotiating an interview, and it was one of those cases where it was just like, I can't answer these questions. I can't go on the record and do this now. And I said, well, when? You know, like, what's it, you know, and I tried to bend over backwards, you know, because it's at the end of filming, and you're like, you know, I never would have, you know, other than this person, I never would have, you know, said, here, let me send you some questions, and I'll try to be general about them. I try to negotiate the way we would do answers, even this person kind of giving, you know, a five-minute kind of statement that we would cut up, and it just didn't happen. But it's somebody who was very, very involved in ECW and their business towards the latter half, who definitely could have shed some light on a few things at the end. I don't think by any means that it ruins our narrative or anything. And in fairness, you know what, Paul Heyman was always, you know, kind of the golden, you know, calf or whatever, the person that, you know, you kind of, the first several years were kind of spent, you know, chasing Paul Heyman. I kind of given up on that. You know, I felt like the content that we got, the Paul Heyman's ideas, ideology, and he has enough friends who were interviewed that kind of speak for the positives of him and also for his mindset. We have a lot of first-person accounts in our film, so not having him is kind of interesting to me because I don't feel you necessarily have to have him to do it. Yeah, I think there's a lot of great documentaries out there that studies somebody who has passed away or somebody who just wouldn't participate.
Right.
So I guess because this other person popped up this year and it became a possibility, that's the person that I most would have liked to have gotten. But, you know, I almost put him on equal footing with Paul. I mean, it's not like if Paul Heyman called me tomorrow and said, listen, I've listened to you go on all these podcasts, and you know what, fine. Let's talk for, you got 20 minutes. I'd talk to him, you know what I mean? Like, of course.
How hard is it as a filmmaker when you do have a subject that you wish, you know, at one time at least, you certainly wished you could get him, and when they don't, and despite your best effort, I mean, does it really go through your mind that, all right, I need to be fair, this can't be a hatchet job, and you almost overcompensate in the other direction by trying to make sure you don't make that person look too bad because they wouldn't do the interview with you? I mean, have you put a lot of thought into that?
Oh, God, yeah, I obsess about these things all the time for years, you know. I certainly spend enough time in the studio, you know. So when we did our rough draft, there were segments that ended up being like 4 minutes that we spent 2 days on discussing, you know, what goes where and how do we form this. And, you know, the good thing is we got a lot of coverage. I mean, we did over 60 interviews with a variety of people. So there isn't, you know, maybe one or two segments that just aren't going to make the film. But for the most part, you know, every segment that we had kind of jotted down, we looked at the raw footage and there was like 15 minutes of raw clips that were cut up in every segment. And we'd watch it and go, do we have a segment? Yeah, okay, well, let's start constructing it. And then the construction took time.
I see. And, you know, jumping back to the wrestlers and maybe how their attitudes were sour when you first approached them and they've lightened up over the years, you know, we've all heard the term Kool-Aid used with Paul Heyman.
Yeah.
Having talked to so many of these guys at various times over the years, how much of it do you think was some guys were buying into the Kool-Aid and others just wanted to believe so badly that maybe deep down they knew things weren't right, this wasn't, you know, things weren't as they were being said, but they just wanted to believe so badly. They were willing to listen to whatever was told to them and just accept it as gospel.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's funny you mentioned that, just because it dawned on me the other day that I think we only have a Paul Heyman Kool-Aid reference once towards the end of the film. There's not a ton of Kool-Aid references, which is funny because you'd think that would come up so much in our film. It really didn't.
Yeah.
I think people expressed it in other ways, more articulate ways, but that simple, like, Paul Heyman Kool-Aid drinker phrase, I think it only, like, made it in once. Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because I think it's actually, you know, pretty fair to say that some of these guys, what else were they going to do? I think, you know, somebody like I hate to keep going back to Axl, but he, you know, he's somebody. I mean, New Jack is somebody. Balls Mahoney is somebody who was very representative of the ECW style. They're kind of name brands within a certain subset of wrestling. They certainly existed and made money off of wrestling, you know, for what, it's been 12 years since it closed down, 11 years. I think those guys felt betrayed, even though rationally speaking, there was no real option. I think maybe they felt betrayed because they got pigeonholed by a combination of Paul Heyman wanting them to do stuff and then them agreeing, and then it became what they do. I think they allowed themselves to kind of, you know, to use, you know, that's a harsh word to use, but they kind of prostituted themselves out, you know, to keep their jobs, to keep their spots, because they felt they needed to do it. And it gave them some tough guy outlaw acclaim. And I think that the fans contribute to that in a sense too. They contribute within the perception of, you know, who these guys are and what they do. Nobody wanted to see Axl Rotten do chain wrestling, you know, because he allowed himself to do barbed wire matches in '95 with Ian Rotten, and then he became, you know, his gimmick was the hardcore chair swing freak, you know, and his body is covered in scars. That's what I'm trying to say. And he's proud of them. He shows them all the time. You know what I mean? So it's a part of his self-identity. So, you know, were guys bitter at the end, or were they in denial? Yeah, because they had been convinced that they were part of a team, because they weren't necessarily main event guys, but they were stars within this subculture. And then the subculture went away, and it's very easy to blame Paul Heyman. I mean, he made it easy because it's not only the business decisions he made, but also the fact that he bailed from the last few months as far as, like, coming to the shows
right,
to talk to the guys. And then he jumped to the WWE and kind of landed on his feet, you know, and he never made phone calls. So, you know, it's very... I would probably be upset, too, if I was them. You know what I mean?
Right.
Rationally, you can understand it, but it doesn't make it right, I guess I'll say.
No, you're absolutely right. Do you think, not in all cases, I'm not trying to say that everyone left there, I'm not trying to paint everyone with one broad stroke, but do you think in a lot of cases, the guys who saw through it were able to move on to other things? And, you know, I'm sure there were some guys that were wise to what was going on and just didn't have that option. But in large part, you know, I mean, do you think there were guys that, I guess what I'm trying to ask, were there guys you think that stuck around through thick and thin at the end that may have had other options, but really did, to, for lack of a better term, drink that Kool-Aid thinking, well, you know, and Paul says it's going to be all right, so I'm still here. Or do you think by then it was kind of down to those guys that stayed because they didn't have anywhere else to go? They just were clinging to the hope that the ride wasn't going to end.
I think the young guys stayed because this was the first place that they got some notoriety, and they thought that if they stayed, you know, I know Angel told me in his interview, Angel from the Baldies, he felt like if he showed the loyalty, because he's a very loyal guy, that he would be rewarded, because he really did think that Paul would come through, because whenever Paul kind of played this, you know, the shell game, so to speak, at the end of the day, he'd pick up the shell and there's TV, there's a pay-per-view deal, there's something, you know. Unfortunately, those deals that he would pick up were never financial, you know, boons for them, you know. But I think the younger guys were more Kool-Aid drinking. But the majority of them were, that's where they were by that point. You know, there was a wrestling war going on, and they weren't being paid. They could have left at any time. I know that a lot of people, you know, say, well, everybody knew that Heyman had WWE's ear. But WCW was giving away crazy, crazy money. And in the end, you know, Paul was giving away crazy money he didn't have either to try to keep guys there. You know, what's the value of Sandman on the national stage in 2000 or 2001? You know, I don't think a lot in terms of, like, super drawing money. To the ECW crowd, yeah, but is he really worth, like, I mean, the way he made it sound to us when I interviewed him, that he was making, like, he signed a deal when he came back for $200,000. He had just been released by WCW, so what were his options?
Right.
I don't really see why you overpay Sandman at that point, you know what I mean? No disrespect to him, because he's definitely, within that subset, somewhat of a drawing card. But is it really that financially, like, you know, what's the risk-reward there? I'm sure there was a lot of that going on.
Yeah, if someone else isn't going to pay you $200,000, why would ECW pay that figure?
Yeah, yeah.
Having, you know, gone through this for so many years, talked to so many people, where do you feel the real beginning of the end was? Was there a specific event that led to it? Overall, I mean, look, as inside as you've been on this and
yeah,
so many people, do you really have a feel for this is what led to it or not really?
No, it's like 10 things. It really is like 10 things, and they weren't all the same day or same week or same month. A lot of people point to the first pay-per-view. They got into that thinking that they could then go national off of it in some way. It ended up being a money drainer for them because you need, at the bare minimum, you need $250,000. I don't know what it is now, but at the time you needed $250,000 bare minimum to put on a pay-per-view. Probably a little more. Now where do you get that money from? You know, and it doesn't come back right away. And it's a crapshoot whether you're making a lot of money off of your pay-per-views. So you got to start taking out high interest loans to do that. That becomes a problem, you know, because then you're spending the money that you would have had to this pay-per-view that's supposed to make you money, and now you're in a dangerous cycle. They started signing guys to crazy contracts to keep them. Not everybody. There were still a lot of guys that were killing themselves for $75 a night. But there were other people who they signed to bigger deals just to keep them because it was a wrestling war. You know, in that sense, you know, I've talked to people who said that Paul Heyman insisted on dealing with the talent's contracts, which was tough because he was a wrestling guy. You know, for as much as people bury Paul Heyman, you know, being a liar, a manipulator, blah, 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 you know, he gave some of these guys a good amount of money that a businessman running it wouldn't have been so apt to give them to stick around.
Yeah.
So, I mean, now he's stuck into these contracts. They signed out that horrible TNN deal because they felt like they had to. They thought that they would make it up because business would double with merch and house shows, and they could expand the house shows nationally, and that's, you know, that didn't happen. And not only that, it's really, once these guys started trying to run like three shows a week, which, you know, isn't a ton, you know, but still three or sometimes four shows a week doing that style, and they never pulled back on their style because now another thing, you know, number 5 out of 10 that we're talking about, their fan base started to change because they pushed so far into that niche. You know, for years they had a little something for everybody. And it's not like that completely disappeared towards the end. I mean, they still had Lance Storm for a while. They still had, you know, Just Incredible versus Jerry Lynn, which is, you know, still good stuff. But, I mean, I've seen, you know, I was at those house shows, and I've seen, in the past month, I've seen a lot of the stuff on tape where if Jerry Lynn wasn't going through a table, people were like, you know, fuck this. What's next? Bring New Jack out. We want to see violence. You know, they started attracting a younger crowd that came in groups, you know, young men who wanted to get drunk before they went to the show. They were really rowdy. You know, the element of danger was always in the room at an ECW show, in the crowd. And that probably limited them. You know, the television penetration that you can get for the style of product that they had limited them, you know, started to cause a problem. The amount of, you know, how long these guys can do these things and how long can you hold on to the ones that are more talented, that became a problem. So there's a million things. And also I think Paul Heyman got really burned out. I don't think there are many great angles that people think of in those last 2 to 3 years.
I think he was trying to wear too many hats. And I guess
Yeah. It
leads into my next question. How far do you think ECW could have gone? You know, if some things had went the right way, or do you just think with the structure they had on the business side of things, it was always, or maybe Paul self-destructive in terms of, you know, some of the crazy things that they did and you know, running through, being, you know, basically running themselves out of various buildings and various business partnerships. Do you think this thing was just doomed to fail?
Oh, they lost so many business deals. They lost so many buildings. Yeah, and he certainly wasn't the best businessman, and they didn't have a centralized office. I know one of the people who worked in the front office said, yeah, we all operated out of our homes all across, you know, the Northeast, all the way down to Florida on cell phones. And you have to get in touch with Paul Heyman to okay and everything. And, you know, the guy's got to produce 2 TV shows at the end. You know, he's producing 2 TV shows, and his entire staff is him, Ron Buffone, and Charlie Brazzisi. You know, and then they got to get, you know, they still had that syndication. There's another thing that killed them. That syndication network cost money. Every station that they were on, it cost something. You know, now you're producing 2 TV shows and you're not making money off of either one of them. And you're hoping, you know, I guess that merch, you know, and tape sales, you know, go up because they had done so well with tape sales in the early days. But it had a limit. I don't know how far it could have gone, to answer your question. I don't think it could have gone. You know, I was a fan back then, but, you know, now that I'm, you know, I'm more of an adult, it's extremely limiting. It was so violent and it narrowcasted by the end. And I don't even know if they got the USA deal that they would have done good. I mean, they were on TNN for over a year. They never really did more than, you know, 1.5 million people, as I recall. Maybe they did 2 million once or twice, but, and that was during wrestling when it was at its most popular. Now you can also argue that if they were the third promotion, they would have had to evolve. Could Paul Heyman have done it? Sure, but I don't know how you. I mean, I've seen that with ROH years later on a much smaller scale, but they fired Gabe Sapolsky and tried to change their philosophy. And they alienated a lot of their fan base, but to bring in new fans, and the new fans, there wasn't enough of them to replace
the
fan base. And I think ECW would have been on a bigger scale. So, you know, creatively, Paul Heyman could have pulled something off, but that presupposes that Paul Heyman all of a sudden gives all the business, he allows the business to be run by a bunch of other people, which probably means somebody else buys into it. And then, you know, Paul Heyman can be a volatile guy. How long is it before, you know, he butts heads with the business people and ends up, you know, splitting the company or walking out or getting fired, you know?
One more Paul Heyman question before we move on to some other things. Maybe somebody sees, I don't know how much you focused on him in your trailers, but let's just say a younger fan or just a non-wrestling fan who's aware of the movie approaches you and says, tell me about this Paul Heyman guy. What do you tell him?
You know, I love this question because this is a question I asked everybody when I was filming, especially when I was younger. You know, almost the exact same question. I think he's smart. I think he's charismatic. I think he is truly the son of a lawyer. I think he knows how to speak. I think he loves to be liked and play games. I don't think he is, you know, an evil person by any means. I think he likes the spotlight and he likes to do creative things that challenge him. He knows how to pick his spots. There's a certain amount of, you know, I don't think people would associate this with Paul Heyman, but, you know, given, you know, the rumors of how he is or the hearsay, but there's a certain amount of creative integrity to him that I really respect. Even when I disagreed with him, the fact that he would not pull back on a lot of things, you know, necessarily change for anybody. I don't think it was necessarily the right decision, but I respect what he was trying to do. I respect the principles in a lot of senses.
And moving away from him, maybe is there someone in all these interviews you've done and that you were surprised at? Is there an unsung hero, at least as far as you know, sites like mine and just the various coverage of ECW over the years, somebody that maybe didn't get as much credit for, or I guess even on the floor, we'll turn this into a two-parter. Is there also someone that maybe didn't get someone that didn't get enough credit on the positive side for the good they did for the company? And also, is there anyone behind the scenes that was a negative, that had a negative impact on this thing that people don't spend a lot of time talking about?
Okay. Well, the easy feel-good answer is probably Tony Lewis, who was a fan who ran strictlyecw.com. He was a really involved fan. Probably the nicest guy in the world, and I'm glad to actually, you know, I consider Tony a friend. And Tony just wanted his ECW. He loved ECW. He fought for them to get on MSG, you know, through organizing fans and starting call-in campaigns and letter-writing campaigns and email campaigns. Then he, you know, fought to get them back on pay-per-view. And then they got on pay-per-view, and Cablevision, where he lived in New York, didn't offer the pay-per-view. So he fought to get them on Cablevision. And then he tried to help out with them getting, you know, expanded national TV, or if they'd lose a market, he had a site, an organizational informational site where people would go to get the, you know, the program director's name or the head of, you know, Q Panero from Request TV. Here's his contact info. Now, did that backfire at times? Absolutely it did. I think he deserves a lot of credit for what he did, because that he is the embodiment of that whole Join the Revolution, you know, marketing campaign that Paul Heyman so cleverly pulled off, not only with fans, but with the wrestlers. Now, in fairness, you know, I will say that I've been told privately, well, you know what, that wasn't so much the fans as, you know, so-and-so taking out these executives on the town in Manhattan and paying for a few bottles of champagne and money talking, you know, working out a financial deal. And, you know, probably that's true, but I think Tony Lewis should probably be recognized, and that's something that we want to do in our film. As far as, you know, I also want to mention that there were a lot of little people who helped out ECW. You know, the Damien Farrens of the world, Gabe Sapolsky, you know, who is like, he's a soldier for Heyman to this day, you know, right or wrong. He swears by Paul Heyman and, you know, certainly helped out. Ed Zahn was an early promoter who did, you know, a lot to get them in early buildings, who's kind of forgotten about from ECW history, you know, possibly because he was the promoter of record the night that they had the fire incident at the arena. And his account of it somewhat differed from, I guess, Paul Heyman and Todd Gordon. So there are those people. As far as a detriment, you know, like, I mean, everybody says Paul Heyman. I don't, you know, I didn't speak, to be fair, I didn't speak, get to counterpoint and point counterpoint with Heyman on a lot of things, obviously. Some people would tell you, you know, Steve Carroll, you know, was painted as a bad guy. You know, he's on the business end of ECW. But the thing is that Paul was there all the time, and he was, you know, he was for the boys, so to speak. And Steve Carroll doesn't hang out with wrestlers. He's a businessman who cares about a bottom line. And from all that I could see, it, you know, he was the one trying to rein in the spending and to protect the deals that they had on the table and try to find better ones. So I think it's kind of a myth that it was, you know, that the buck gets passed to him and it's his fault, you know.
Maybe someone needed to be the bad guy when someone didn't want to be portrayed as that?
I would say that's accurate.
Okay. And I kind of saved the cliche one rather than start with it. I knew we'd have to get to it sooner or later, but I'm sure you've answered it in all the interviews you've done. What really attracted you to ECW?
The promos at first. I'm sure the violence did. You know, when I was a teenager and I didn't think about head trauma and, you know, the price these guys pay, you know, they were always on TV the next week, so you figured, you know, they're probably, you know, they figured out how to do it, you know. The problem was at first, though. The television show was so revolutionary. I've always loved niche things, things that are creative, that are outside of, you know, that homogenized corporate feel. And that's, you know, why I liked ROH at the beginning, too. I just thought they presented something different. It was a perfect artistic reaction in the Northeast to the ECW thing, having run its course. So the TV show, Heyman's whole presentation, you know, he really, I mean, I think he gets a lot of credit for it. But it's something, and we certainly recognize it in our film as far as the things that he did differently with television and with no budget, you know. It's really amazing.
When you mentioned Ring of Honor a couple of times, having followed that, were you, at any point did you have any thoughts that, boy, this would be make for a hell of a follow-up documentary?
I did very early on because we knew those guys. I knew Gabe and I knew Rob Feinstein because I had interviewed them for my documentary. And I went, you know, I bought a ticket and went as a fan to the first show they ever did, and I was blown away by it. I loved it. So I probably went to 50 or 60 Ring of Honor shows up until, like, I think the last one I went to was sometime last year. But there was a time when we were shooting there. They ended up not giving us permission for, like, their third show. I think I said, hey, can we shoot some footage because there's some ECW guys on the card? And I had a sneaking idea of, like, maybe I could, you know, I didn't know how I was going to present it to Kev, but I was like, maybe we could get this from the ground floor. But it just didn't work out, you know. And then, you know, we stopped production and ROH kept going. I just would go as a fan, you know what I mean? So there was an idea of it, but I don't think the next thing we do will have anything to do with wrestling, to be honest with you.
Yeah, what is next? Have you figured that out, or are you just so focused on this?
We have, like, four or five very rough ideas. We're trying not to get ahead of ourselves. I mean, this might not be a success at all, and then where are we, you know? If we get the option where we can make something and somebody would, you know, fund it because we had some success with this, I would love to do something. It probably, like I said, it won't have anything to do with wrestling, but it'll probably be another documentary. And there are, like, four or five very rough ideas of what we would do. I mean, we discuss them sometimes in the studio as we're kicking around stuff. We never let ourselves get that far. We don't want to take our eyes off the goal. At this point, this, you know, has to come out, you know. We don't want to take our eyes off of that, you know.
Right. Are you open to coming back to wrestling at some point down in the future? If there's, you know, have you been keeping your eye open just to, you know, other than the Ring of Honor, maybe there's something that I'm not even thinking of that it's just as a filmmaker, you're like, I could see where that might have some possibility.
Yeah, I mean, I was asked this more directly in an interview I did like 2 weeks ago. Somebody said, like, what, you know, wrestling promotions or territories. And we just kind of had, like, an open discussion on their airwaves about it. Well, if it happens, it would involve – Kevin Cannon probably wouldn't be involved in it. And there's at least a slight chance of it, you know what I mean? I couldn't think of what to do that wouldn't be a complete hassle. That's the thing, is that, like, whatever we do next is going to be so much simpler than not dealing with wrestling personnel because it's such a goofy, closed world, you know?
Right.
What do you do? Like, I think something like Portland, you know, wrestling would be interesting, but Paul, I think it's Paul Owen who ran it. He's dead now. I mean, I guess you could get Piper and a few people. I think Playboy Buddy Rhodes has passed on and he was one of the mainstays there. I think that they're kind of unrecognized, and I think I've seen some old Portland footage and I think they might have some interesting stories. The thing is, there's so many things that have to align because it has to be a good narrative. It also has to be something that's at least a little bit viable because, I mean, somebody's going to have to pay for it and then they're going to want, you know, their money, some return on their investment kind of a thing. I mean, the biggest one, of course, is, like, you know, a searching for Vince McMahon kind of documentary about WWE. That's a nightmare when it comes to access and, you know, and the way that they could block you from doing things. It's like, I guess you could do Calgary, but can you imagine trying to navigate the Hart family and the finding the truth and all of that? So I don't know, and of course I love the World Class documentary. I thought that I can't think of his, I think it's Brian James. I hope I'm not getting that wrong. I thought that was great. So you can't do World Class.
The WWE version or the other version?
No, the independent version. And in fairness, the WWE version was interesting too, obviously the independent one really kind of focused on the things more so that I would care about. It's like, I just don't know what we would do, that I could be this passionate about, because I want to do something that I care about, if you're going to spend a lot of your life doing it.
How concerned were you when WWE released their ECW documentary and also the Forever Hardcore documentary was released? Or at that point, had you just been like, well, man, we're this one's off the table, and were you just at that point where you didn't think you were going to do anything with this footage?
Oh, I was crushed, Jason.
Really?
Words cannot describe the depression that I felt sitting there watching that with Kev, especially the Forever Hardcore, because I could see, like, it's one thing when WWE produces, something that, is semi, it has an agenda, it's semi-propaganda, it's very much focused on angles and wrestling. I wanted to do something independent, and then, Forever Hardcore came out, and I didn't really like Forever Hardcore, to be honest with you. I thought it was, like, too insider, it was kind of unfocused, the other thing is that when they had an interview with Todd Gordon, it looks exactly like my interview that I had shot with him years before, just because they did it in Todd's office, too. But it was like, oh, my God, I just remember seeing this just, like, going, like, wow, all this time put, And then the more I watched and I thought about it over the years, I went, man, there's so much stuff that they didn't cover correctly. They didn't get coverage on, or they just, the two of them avoided. I just felt like there's something that we could make that A, wrestling fans could be proud of, that felt a little different or more complete or fair, more well-rounded, I guess I'd say. And also something that, because the thing is, I don't know anybody, I loved Rise and Fall, but who that's not a wrestling fan watched Rise and Fall of ECW?
Right.
So I wanted to do something to get this subculture out there. So I understand when people go, oh, ECW, like, because if you spend your day on the internet and you buy newsletters and you're deeply involved in that, it's a very obsessive culture in a way. I understand if you're like, oh, ECW, but the thing is that 95% of the world doesn't know about ECW or that, or their contributions to wrestling that helped lead to the boom in wrestling in the late 90s,
It's safe to say that maybe Forever Hardcore had that in, they were catering to a different audience. They weren't going for that, the everyone out there. It was more, you said it was a little too insider. Do you think that was by design?
It had to be. It had to be, because I remember Kevin looking over at me and saying, if I didn't know the story, because he's not a wrestling person, but he knows the story. And he said, if I didn't know the story because it was my job for years to figure out a narrative, I don't really know that I'd understand any of this. So, that made me go like, oh, okay, all right, there's that, It certainly still crushed me when those came out, though, But we made a much better film for it, It challenged us to say, is there still something in our content that's interesting? It helped us get rid of all, anything storyline or angle driven, really, or character driven. I thought they all did a great job of profiling characters that people remembered fondly,
John, is there an existing documentary, maybe one on pro wrestling or maybe, something people have seen that you would compare the style of, we'll just call it your unauthorized ECW documentary to?
No, But that doesn't mean we're like super unique or anything. I'm struggling to think of something that is a complete parallel. I mean, I loved Wrestling with Shadows. I thought that was really good. But that, you know, more followed, or that was a different style of documentary than we do. Same with Beyond the Mat. I mean, we ended up not following around people. So you have a lot more sit-down stuff. And, I mean, we do have the reunion stuff, so I guess there is. There are people moving about in our film. No, I mean, I don't think anybody, you know, did kind of what we're doing, like reaching out to the wrestling media. You know, that's the one thing that always kind of blew me away. I would watch great documentaries about, like, rock music or even Welcome to Death Row, which was about Death Row Records, and they had people, you know, journalists who covered it, you know, talking about it, and I always thought, like, why doesn't anybody reach out to the wrestling journalists if you're going to do a documentary about pro wrestling? It just didn't make sense to me. Something that I wanted to, you know, really include those guys in. That's something I think that's really unique about what we're doing.
Have you had a chance to see Memphis Heat?
I have. I was thinking of that a minute ago. I'm trying to recall it. I liked Memphis Heat. I actually wish they would have had, like, a big version that went, like, really deeper.
Sure.
You know? I thought it was really fun. I really liked Memphis Heat. And it kind of spotlighted some stuff, like the Kaufman stuff, that actually didn't, like, draw huge, but that everybody remembers fondly. So I liked it. I wish it would have been, there's such a story on Memphis, you know, there's a documentary that would take you another 10 years, but cause they scratched the surface with it. Definitely. You know, I could see like there are some parallels here and there to Memphis Heat, and us. I think that would be fair. I really do like Memphis Heat.
Trying to think if there's anything else, another like documentary out there that I'm just forgetting.
Yeah, that's the thing. There aren't like a ton of wrestling documentaries that really like strive to be kind of mainstream, or that, you know, or like I said, like Wrestling with Shadows is great, but it follows around Bret Hart and deals with a situation. You know, ours is, you know, we have a lot of sit down interview stuff and a lot of discussion stuff. It's, you know, it was a little different.
Well, shifting gears, not so much John the documentary maker, John the fan.
Sure.
You've attended some of the, at least you mentioned the Extreme Reunion show.
Yeah, but I had to work.
I
didn't like hang out and watch the show.
Okay, but just as a fan, what is your take on the many ECW reunion shows we've seen, even like unofficial ones that TNA has done? I mean, do you... Are you in the market for that? I mean, when they announce these things, are you like, man, I want to go to that, or is it just let it die?
I don't know that it's let it die. This is an interesting question because I'm, you know, there are certain people that write me and they're like, why won't you let it die? Let the legacy, you know, of ECW, blah blah blah, and I'm like, well, I'm trying to examine what the legacy is. You know, I think this is the time to do that now that it's 10 years on. And my whole point is, you know, I'm not doing like a reunion show or a reunion documentary. I would have been in the market. Had I had the money, I would have gone up for the first One Night Stand. I think that was like an important show, and that showed kind of a wave of what people still held closely or held dear about ECW. The second one was a fun spectacle because Cena was on it, but it really wasn't quite the same. I did not enjoy from the moment it started, I did not enjoy the reboot of ECW as a WWE product, as a TV show. It was just, well, A, it wasn't that good,
no.
But B, it just was kind of so against the spirit of ECW, where you could make a case that that definitely the first and more than likely the second kind of had that spirit. The show really didn't. I don't think I've ever personally attended any ECW reunion, come to think of it. The TNA thing, I didn't really interest me, but I was very intrigued by the thought of Paul Heyman being given a piece of the company and coming in and bringing, the rumor was he was going to bring Sapolsky. And I can't think of the other gentleman's name.
Oh, why is it escaping me?
The former Red, David Lagania.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. I think that would have been fascinating. I would have loved to see Paul Heyman work with some of these younger guys. I think that would have been interesting, but it didn't happen. And that certainly wouldn't have been an ECW reboot, but it would have been a really great experiment and a test to see how good Paul Heyman was as a booker.
Yeah, and I don't think it would have looked anything like ECW.
No, I don't either. Not at all. And that's what I love about Paul Heyman. You know, that's something that he adapts. He has more than one idea, you know, and I think that's awesome. For the record, I'm not a huge fan of the hardcore style anymore, to be honest with you.
I don't think there's too many people that are, really.
Yeah, I cringe when I watch these fan cams and I see these things. I cringe when I would see it in ROH. It's just, for the most part, it's terribly unnecessary to telling your story, and it's really kind of it's a zero-sum game. It's a shortcut most of the time, and it becomes, when you do it too much, how do you top it? You know, that's something that I've seen in going back and watching some of the ECW from the later days. You know, people having chair shot battles, and it's like the midpoint of the match. And they're taking like three chair shots in a row. They're not selling anything. And then they're moving on from it. And the finish isn't nearly as spectacular. You know, I think that style has borne out to be, you know, an intriguing kind of footnote. But I hope that that's not all that ECW or Paul Heyman are remembered for.
Yeah, sadly, by a lot of people, I think it is. I mean, that was one of the things that, yeah, sure, the violence appealed to me when I was, watching at that time as just a younger viewer and whatnot, or, you know, younger than I am now at least. But it really was you got the combo platter with ECW when it was at its best. And like you, it was the promos, the characters, because they were... It wasn't just, here's your basic character that, you know.
Here's your plumber. Here's the guy who plays basketball, and everything he talks about is about basketball, yeah.
They had layers. They had depth, and the guys, mm-hmm. I mean, they just believed in those characters. And that's the thing that when people try to recreate ECW with the various knockoff promotions that have come and gone, and some are even starting up again, that's what I wish they would figure out. It's not about burning tables and barbed wire. And it's easier said than done, because I don't know that these promotions have access to anyone that has the creative mind of Paul Heyman. But I at least wish they would figure out that it really is it was character driven, and like you said, there was just more to it than hardcore.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I echo everything that you said there. You know, and that's what's unfortunate is people just see, and part of that is Heyman's fault in the latter stages. Just because he wanted to push the envelope so much and not pull back, that he just allowed his product to kind of become that. And I think people remember it more because on the national stage it was a lot of that.
Yeah.
But that's completely unfair. I think that, you know, if people feel that way, you should see my film, because it's, you know, somewhat debunks that as far as the entire history of it.
And how much, you mentioned the chair shots. How much of that do you get into in the film? Is that just the damage that was done, head trauma and whatnot? Is that focused on at all?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a segment about blading and bleeding. We have a segment about, you know, the violence, the chair shots and whatnot. And we also have a segment about the escalation of violence as they got towards the latter years when they started doing flaming tables and New Jack was doing balcony dives and, you know, they were doing crazy stuff with barbed wire. So we examine those things throughout the film. I think that's what makes it unique, and that's something that, you know, wrestling promotions or people in wrestling don't necessarily think to examine or want to examine, because the kind of things that come out of it are, maybe we shouldn't be doing these things, or this is a crazy business, or, you know, it turns a critical eye to it.
And the finished product, you're hoping to have this out, or is it a firm deadline, December?
We're hoping. You know, I can't, you know, say 100% positive, because, you know, there's three of us doing everything, and really there's two of us, because the project manager, Steve, is just kind of mining the ship for us and keeping things going and looking out for our business interests. But creatively, Kevin and I really are the ones doing this. So, I mean, we're shooting for December. There's still a lot of work to be done. I work on it every day. And I keep crazy hours, and little by little we're chipping away at it. like I said, we have a first draft done. Now we're whittling that down to try to get something. But yeah, I mean, we've got to get two versions done and on to a DVD and get that sent to everybody and hopefully have a premiere in the Philadelphia area that we can be proud of.
And are you at that point now where, barring a Paul Heyman or the other person you don't care to mention, is I kind of suspect who it is, but I'm not going to press you on it. If unless it's someone at that level, are you pretty much done with interviews, or are you still open to doing more?
There's always a director's cut, you know, so we're not completely against it, but we've got so much content that we're looking for something unique that fits into what we're doing. I mean, I've had offers from people, but I don't think that they really... They don't necessarily know exactly, you know, what we're getting into, the way we're looking at it. So I think they think that they're going to tell me, you know, cute stories about angles or backstage stuff that really doesn't fit into my narrative.
Right.
We're not completely opposed to it. We're still talking to one or two people about stuff. I mean, and like I said, there's always, you know, the ridiculous director's cut for a geek like me who always wanted to make a completist, you know, thing. There's a lot of tough cuts that have to be made that I'm not looking forward to. You know,
do you fear that it does get to the point where, I mean, you have so many hours of footage, so many interviews, where just it becomes too much, and you're just trying to cram too much into one movie?
Well, yeah, that's why Kevin Karen's here, because he wants to make the best film possible. So Kevin, well, first of all, he's got the final say on the film festival cut, which will come in at probably no more than an hour 40. And as far as the extended cut, I mean, I'm in charge of it. You know, we're gonna butt heads a lot during it. But I know that there's always, you know, you can always get the footage out elsewhere. You can always do a director's cut. You can always, you know, put stuff out on the internet. You know, like I said, we've got it whittled down. At worst case scenario of like, you know, 3 hours. You know, eventually, maybe a year from now, if everything goes well, we can put out the, hey, watch this in two sittings, you know, director's cut kind of thing.
Gotcha. Well, anything else that maybe we didn't touch on that you'd like to say about this, or even one final sales pitch to help you guys out via Kickstarter?
Yeah, just go to Kickstarter.com, search ECW. I mean, if you've heard a lot during this interview, but I'm sure there's one or two things I missed, just read through everything, watch a few of the videos, you know, make a pledge if you want. There's gifts for everything that you pledge. You know, I really like to sell, you know, more DVDs, and I'd also like to be comfortably above the, you know, the goal, the minimums goal that we did reach. As you never know if something could happen. So, you know, I'm still hopeful of getting a little bit more padding just so we don't have to worry about things so much, you know. And I just want to, you know, I want people to want to see it. So I want them to, you know, buy a package where you get the DVD, or buy a package where you get the DVD, a T-shirt, and you come to the premiere. There's a lot of people I want to thank. You know, there's a lot of people that have, you know, rallied to the cause for us that are going to be coming to a premiere when we can finally set a date that, you know, I want to give a hug to and thank, you know.
Well, and I want to wish you the best of luck with this. I am amazed by the passion, the fact that you guys have, even though, yeah, you've had to take some breaks, that you've stuck with it. I mean, this... You guys didn't set out, you know, it really isn't you guys setting out to make $1 million. You set out to just make this project. The level of passion you've showed, it really is incredible, and I applaud you for that.
Thank you very much, Jason, and thank you for your support over the years.
Oh, absolutely my pleasure. John, we will talk again soon, and everybody check out that Kickstarter if you can help. Great, and like you said about one of those packages, you're essentially paying for, you know, you're prepaying for a DVD, and I really look forward to the movie. I'm curious to see what the hell I said. It's been so many years, but I guess final question, John, who was the best looking bald internet reporter from the Midwest that you interviewed?
The man that I affectionately nicknamed Bulldog during our, I don't know if you remember that.
I forgot about that. Now that you mention it, I do remember.
Yeah. Yes, it was you, Jason Powell.
I would like to think that, you know, somehow, some way, this is going to lead to me being like a leading man actor someday.
I think the best that you can hope for is maybe somebody sees it and the next time there's something horrible that happens in wrestling, Nancy Grace will call you to be an analyst, and you can you can answer questions for 5 seconds, and she'll just cut you off. You don't say what she wants you to say.
Exactly. Oh my God, that woman. I mean, it's the whole project. I'm excited to see the finished product. I'm sure you're excited to see the finished product.
Yeah. Oh my God, yeah.
It's been something else. But God, Nancy Grace. Wow. Have you heard me rail on her before, or is that
No. It just popped into my head. I just thought of the way wrestling was given this huge, you know, I shouldn't say wrestling was giving, but the world was given this huge story that could expose, you know, some of the negatives about wrestling and concussions and whatnot. And they just completely went with this crazy and sensationalized roid rage story. And I just remember her getting some wrestling journalists on there, and she'd ask them a question, cut them off the minute they started talking. She's horrible. She's a horrible person.
You and I mean, we're on the same page. I've made the exact same complaint about her. It's funny. That's why I was asking if you've heard me complain, because, I mean, it's just you're taking the words right out of my mouth. And it's really made me, you know, I'm not a big TV news guy. I'm not into politics and all that. And it's made me so just on guard when it comes to, you know, when I do actually, if there's a big story or something, it just put me on guard for
yeah.
What it I'm doesn't, seeing. I lost a lot of trust in the mainstream media because of that situation.
It doesn't promote intelligent discourse, and it promotes fear and promotes emotional reactions, and it just promotes a lot of negative things that aren't rational to me.
You know what? I think we'll save this for another time, another interview. Let's wrap this up. John, thank you very much for the time, and best of luck with the project.
All right. Thank you, Jason.